least 231 Palestinians, including 65 children, are killed in Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip since May 10. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki says that the Palestinians will never stop resisting the Israeli occupation. The World Health Organization is warning that progress made against the COVID pandemic remains fragile. International travel should be avoided. Hi, this is World News from Tehran. I'm Eruz Zafir. Good to have you with us. Beginning with a top story, Israeli forces carrying out more strikes on the Gaza Strip on the 11th day of the onslaught against the besieged Palestinian territory. Warplanes pounded residential buildings in Gaza City and the southern city of Khan Yunis. Earlier, three people were killed and 20 others got wounded in airstrikes and artillery attacks on Khan Yunis, Gaza City, and a Palestinian refugee camp in central Gaza. More than 230 people have been killed, including 65 children, since Israel launched a devastating offensive on the populated coastal sliver on May 10th. Nearly half of the victims are women and children. Over 1,700 Palestinians have been injured, some 100,000 displaced. Our correspondent Shannon says that Palestinian medics are reporting injuries caused by Israel's use of international banned weapons on the Gaza Strip.
Right now I'm standing inside the courtyard of Al-Shifa Hospital, the main medical complex for the entire Gaza Strip. Health officials have warned of a huge shortage in hospital supplies and surgical supplies. Earlier today, Dr. Ashraf Al-Ghidra, the spokesperson of the Ministry of Health, said that Israel has used internationally banned weapons against people in Gaza. And this is not the first time. The Israeli regime used white peat or white phosphorus in 2008, and that was documented. And the injuries that have been coming here, people are torn to pieces. Some people, their bodies intact. There's nothing wrong with them. You can look at them, it looks alive, but they're dead. Their internal organs exploded because of the weapons that the Israeli regime has been using in recent days.
Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki says that his people will never stop resisting the Israeli occupation. Addressing a UN General Assembly meeting, Maliki said that Israel continues to violate international humanitarian law. He noted that the regime has been forcing the Palestinians to leave their homes for decades. Maliki urged the international community to hold Israel responsible for the atrocities and stop giving impunity to the regime. Also in opening remarks at the Special General Assembly session, the UN Secretary General said that he was deeply shocked by Israel's continued bombardment of the Gaza Strip. Antonio Guterres called for an immediate ceasefire. He said 100,000 Palestinians have been internally displaced and forced to take refuge in mosques and UN-run schools. At the same time, Palestinian resistance groups have conducted more rocket attacks into Israel in response to the continued strikes on the Gaza Strip. The Hamas military wing, the Izzeddin al-Qassam Brigades, hit Ashkelon in southern Israel with a barrage of rockets, leaving one person injured. The group also targeted howitzer weapon systems near the city of Sderot. Earlier, the brigades fired missiles at Israel's military bases of Mishmar Hinegev and Tselem. The Israeli military says that 4,070 rockets have been fired from the besieged territory in the past 11 days. According to medics, a dozen Israelis have been killed in Palestinian retaliatory attacks. Palestinian groups say that they will carry out more attacks if Israel does not stop the strikes on Gaza. Okay, now time for the news review section of this broadcast. U.S. Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders has introduced a resolution which calls for blocking a $735 million sale of precision-guided weapons to Israel. Sanders lamented the fact that U.S.-made bombs are devastating the Gaza Strip, killing women and children there. He said Americans need to take a hard look at whether the weapons sales fuel conflict between Israel and Palestinians. President Joe Biden's administration recently approved the potential sale of weapons to Israel and sent it to Congress for formal review. Sanders' resolution follows a similar motion introduced by U.S. Democratic representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Mark Pocan, and Rashida Tlaib. The measures are likely to pass in either the House or the Senate, where bipartisan support for arms sales to Israel has traditionally been strong. Let me now invite a couple of guests to this news review. We'll have our own correspondent, Mona Candale. In Ramallah, we'll go to Mona first, and then I'll call in a couple of more guests. Mona, what's the situation? What's the latest happening there?
Well, here in the occupied West Bank, more Palestinians had succumbed to their injuries that they had sustained during the recent protests that had been taking place across the occupied West Bank in protest of the ongoing Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. Today we are speaking about it. 29 Palestinians were shot by the Israeli army fire, including four children and a woman who was shot dead by the Israeli soldiers at one of the military checkpoints or close to the illegal settlement of Kiryat Arba in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. Palestinians, however, today had been angered by statements came from the German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas, where he was visiting Israel, the occupied territories, and he met with his Israeli counterpart, Gabi Ashkenazi. The Israeli minister of the German minister of foreign affairs said that Israel has the right to defend itself, including the right to destroy infrastructure from which future attacks can be launched, meaning he means the Palestinian resistance groups from the Gaza Strip. And when he arrived at the Israeli Ben-Gurion airport, he said that in order for a durable peace to be reached, then this requires both the Israelis and the Palestinians be in a position to run their own affairs. After his visit to Israel, the German foreign minister came to the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah, where he was supposed to meet with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Immediately, we received remarks from the Palestinian presidency office saying that this meeting would be closed, no media coverage, no statements following the meeting, and this means that the president himself is very angry. However, Palestinian activists here in Ramallah City immediately rushed to the streets to protest his visit, urging President Abbas not to welcome him or to receive him at the presidential compound Al-Muqata'a. They were chanting anti-Israel slogans as well as slogans against Germany, saying that by his statements, he's supporting the crimes being committed and the massacres against the people of the Gaza Strip.
Okay, thanks for that, Mona Kendall in Ramallah for us. Now, let me invite a couple of our analysts. We have Mick Napier with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Edinburgh. Also, we have John Felpot, a financial criminal lawyer in Montreal. Welcome, both gentlemen. Mick, let's have your comments regarding what the German foreign minister said regarding what's going on. Israelis defending themselves? Are they really defending themselves?
He might well add Germany had the right to defend itself against Jews during the Second World War. This is so beyond despicable. The sons and grandchildren of people who were unable to stop grotesque crimes against European Jews are still applauding genocidal violence against Palestinians. There's a continuity here which is absolutely shameful. And I don't want to exaggerate, but let me say there was the excellent, the brilliant, wonderful Israeli journalist Amira Haas, wrote yesterday an article with a lot of information that Israel was wiping out entire Palestinian families on purpose. And she provided information of the number of families, 12 that have been either fully or largely wiped out during this particular bombing. She looked back to 2014, the killing of 2,000 Palestinians, 25% children, and she said 142 families during that onslaught had been wiped out wholly or partly. Friends of mine lost 11 members of their family in one bomb, for example, including 6 children. This is genocidal violence, and there's no other word for it. And for the German foreign minister to talk about defense is absolutely disgraceful. And I have to say, Israel's involvement in genocidal violence is not restricted to Gaza and to the Palestinians. There are numerous examples of crusading journalists and lawyers in Israel who've asked to see papers about Israeli arms sales to Rwanda, to Myanmar during the expulsion of the Rohingya, to Bosnia, and it's been refused by the High Court there because it could threaten national security. No, it could embarrass the Israeli government, because they have much to hide in terms of using the expertise that they gather in the killing of Palestinians to sell this equipment for those people who wish to kill other national minorities. Mm-hmm. Let me just say that Brigadier General El Cabetz, in an arms fair in New Mexico in 2012, said openly, Gaza is a great laboratory for us, and that is the situation. Israel can actually use the occupation and the crimes against the Palestinians to its commercial advantage. It's really concerning also that those progressives in America who called for America to respect, to say Israel, America has a responsibility for human rights. Everywhere the American empire extends, Central America, Vietnam, anywhere around the world, it risks the massive violation of human rights. Far from being protectors of human rights,
right,
the U.S. government is violating them in Palestine, but it's all part of a long-term habit.
Okay, now let me turn to Montreal, John Philpott is there. John, how do you look at this? You're an international criminal lawyer, and then first of all, tell us about how do you get the news about, if you really get the truth about what's going on between the Palestinians and Israelis these days, and how do people are reacting across the world. And then we have the Prime Minister in Israel saying that we will continue with those, what many people call crimes against humanity and war crimes. As long as Israel's aim is not met, we'll continue with that. Whereas the Palestinians are calling for international mediation. They say that we are for peace.
There's so many things to say. The U.S. is the boss. Israel is a colony of the U.S. And the U.S. bears ultimate responsibility with their repeated, I think it's 3 vetoes at the Security Council. And the other countries are calling for ceasefire and respect for Jerusalem and the end to pogroms, attacks on the Palestinian civilians, and the end to the crimes in Gaza. Now, the U.S. is responsible. They're approving, is it $750 million of arms, precision arms, to do better when they attack Gaza? They are responsible as parties to an offense in the same way as if I advise my son to rob a bank. Now, the U.S. will face eventually criminal responsibility for their crimes, and it's time for the U.S. to respect international law. And as my colleague says, the U.S. commits war crimes around the world. And I mean, we hear them talking about genocide in Xinjiang of Muslims, which of course is hogwash, but how can they be taken seriously? The U.S.'s credibility is going down and down and down. The ICC has the jurisdiction, and hopefully they will act on this. Up to now they haven't, but maybe we're heading some kind of progress. I'm just shocked at the U.S., but remember, I'm of the age that remember the Vietnam War, and was it 3 million Vietnamese killed wantonly, knowingly by the U.S.? They lost the war, of course. Right. And so we cannot count on the U.S. benevolence. They have to be stopped in the many ways that can be stopped, politically, maybe militarily. I don't know. I don't have guns. I don't know much about military affairs. But it's time to stop. And right now, there is a strong resistance. The international balance of power is tilting somewhat in favor of Palestine. Okay. And let's hope that it continues and that this problem can be resolved as the Palestinians want, with their right to self-determination. They can decide how they will settle with Israel and have people living in that region between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments and contribution. We had Mona Candela, correspondent in Ramallah. Then we had Mick Napier with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Edinburgh. And also John Felpott, international criminal lawyer in Montreal, with their comments and contribution. The World Health Organization is cautioning Europeans against international travel as the countries on the continent are easing COVID-related restrictions.
Most of us are still susceptible to the virus and not vaccinated yet. Right now, in the face of a continued threat and new uncertainty, we need to continue to exercise caution and rethink or avoid international travel. Vaccines may be a light at the end of the tunnel, but we cannot be blinded by that light.
The Hans Kluge expressed concerns that progress against the pandemic remains fragile. He said that local outbreaks of COVID-19 could have spread quickly if caution is not exercised. The WHO's Europe director says that the Indian variant has been identified in around half the countries on the continent, but noted that current vaccines are effective enough. But that warning is made a day after the European Union agreed to ease travel restrictions for visitors from outside of the bloc. According to statistics from Reuters, Europe has recorded some 46 million COVID cases and close to 1.1 million related deaths. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box 19395-7 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
A self-powered robot inspired by a fish can survive the extreme pressures at the bottom of the ocean's deepest trench thanks to its soft body and distributed electronic system, and might enable exploration of the uncharted ocean. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Cecilia Lasci Ryder. This article is published under the heading Soft Robot Reaches the Deepest Part of the Ocean. Stay tuned for more. Riding in nature, Li et al. Report a robot made from soft materials that can brave the unexplored depth of the sea. Remarkably, the authors demonstrate that the robot can operate in the Mariana Trench, the deepest part of the ocean. Conventional underwater vehicles require watertight enclosures made of metallic materials to withstand the high pressures of the deep ocean. The thickness and dimensions of these enclosures have to be increased to cope with greater depth. But in Li and colleagues' robot, the delicate electronic components are embedded and distributed in soft silicon, a design that removes the need for pressure-resistant cases. Largely inspired by living organisms, the field of soft robotics involves making robots from pliable materials. Polymers such as silicon are often used, as well as highly deformable structures such as braids and textiles. Soft robots are intrinsically safer than their conventional rigid counterparts in interactions with humans, and their pliability can boost many capabilities, such as their dexterity when manipulating objectives, and their ability to squeeze into tight spaces or to travel across uneven surfaces. Marine species such as squid and octopus were one of the original inspirations for soft robotics research. But soft robotics in turn offers a new approach for tackling marine applications of robots. Li and colleagues' work is a powerful demonstration of this. The author's robot is designed to have a fish-like body shape and two flapping side fins. The authors used a well-established mechanism to drive flapping. The fins are attached to muscles on the robot's body. These are made of a soft material that converts electrical energy into mechanical work. When an electric current from the robot's battery is applied to the muscles, they contract. Tiny solid structures mechanically connect the contracting muscles to the fins, making them flap. One of the challenges faced by Li and co-workers was finding a way to protect the robot's electronic components from high pressures. Taking inspiration from the bones in the skull of the cattle, snail fish, the authors space the electronic components apart rather than packing them together as is typically done in electronic devices. Laboratory tests and simulations demonstrated that this arrangement reduces the stress at the interfaces between components under pressure. The distributed electronics were then embedded in silicon for incorporation into the robot. This approach is more practical and cheaper than other methods for protecting electronics in deep sea devices. Li et al. First tested the swimming ability of the robot in the lab, in a pressurized water chamber. The robot was connected to a pole, which it swam around in a circle. The machine was then tested in a lake at a depth of 70 meters, where it swam freely at a speed of 3.16 centimeters per second. And then in South China Sea, at a depth of about 3,200 meters. It reached a speed of 5.19 centimeters, equivalent to 45/10 body length per second, which is in line with the capabilities of other soft robots. Finally, the flapping movement and pressure resistance of the robot were tested in the Mariana Trench, where it was connected to a conventional underwater robot for support, which also took images of the test. Several previous attempts have been made to develop soft robots for applications underwater, a realm in which it is challenging for robots to interact delicately with objects because robotic sensors don't work well in this environment. Soft robotic grippers offer substantial advantages over rigid grasping devices when collecting and handling delicate sea organisms for study by marine biologists. And bio-inspired soft robotic fishes can swim among other animals without distressing them, thereby allowing close-up study. Li and co-workers' research now pushes the boundaries of what can be achieved. The replacement of rigid protective enclosures for electronic components by distributed electronics embedded in a soft material paves the way for a new generation of deep-sea explorers. There is, however, more work to do before the ocean can be populated with robots of this type of design. Li and co-workers' machine is slower than previously reported underwater robots and cannot withstand sizable disturbances. It could easily be swept away by underwater currents. Its locomotor capabilities will also need to be optimized for practical applications. However, Li and colleagues' approach lays the foundations for future generations of resilient and reliable deep-sea explorers. In the long term, one can predict avenues of research being opened up for marine biology, in which soft robots safely navigate coral reefs or underwater caves to collect delicate specimens without damaging them. Swarms of underwater soft robots with the ability to crawl on the seabed, anchor themselves on to specific structures, or swim over particular areas could contribute to the development of technologies for various other applications. These might include monitoring the ocean, cleaning up, and preventing sea pollution, or preventing marine biodiversity. More fundamentally, they could help researchers to explore the vast uncharted depths of the oceans. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Last Days in Vietnam, directed by Rory Kennedy. And joining me in the studio, we have Dave Calhoun, who is a film critic with Time Out magazine. And beside him is Lindsay German, who is the founding member and convener of the British anti-war organization Stop the War Coalition. Now, Last Days in Vietnam examines the chaotic final days of the US's presence in Vietnam and their efforts to help evacuate 135,000 South Vietnamese people as the North Vietnamese forces were closing in on Saigon. Featuring contemporary reflections from those who were there, this documentary also shows the moral dilemmas faced by US soldiers and diplomats during the unsanctioned evacuation.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam. We have adopted a plan for the complete withdrawal of all U.S. combat ground forces. We are finally bringing American men home.
The American troops were gone, and as a result, the House of Cards began to collapse.
We were dealing with an ambassador who was just convinced that somehow there wouldn't have to be an evacuation, and therefore there wouldn't have to be a concern about evacuating South Vietnamese.
These people were dead men walking. Sometimes there's an issue not of legal and illegal, but right or wrong. I borrowed a truck, and I drove them to the airbase. I had told them, when you hear three thumps, that means hold the baby's mouths, don't breathe, don't talk, don't make any noise. I was going to get them out.
The final battle of Saigon has begun.
That morning, there must have been at least 10,000 people ringing the embassy.
There was a sea of people wanting to get out. They looked up at the helicopters leaving, and I could see their eyes. That's good eyes.
There are no words to describe what a ship looks like. The hull is 200 and it's got 2,000 on it.
We have no more helicopters. That's it.
As it took off, I could see the group right where we had left them. It was just so serious and deep a betrayal. Who goes? And who gets left behind?
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, the US fought in the Vietnam War for nearly 20 years, from 1955 to 1975. And of course, their alleged role was to stop the spread of communism. But of course, in this documentary, it doesn't really talk about this aspect of the war. More so, it focuses on the last days of the US troops in Vietnam, as the title of the documentary suggests. And Dave, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, how would you summarize what Last Days in Vietnam is about, and what was your take on it?
As you say, it's a particularly human story. It looks at the, as the title says, the final days of American involvement in 1975 in South Vietnam, and particularly in Saigon. After the withdrawal of troops in 1973, there were still between 5,000 and 7,000 US military personnel or advisors still in South Vietnam, many of them in Saigon. And what the film does is, using archive footage and new interviews, it builds up a portrait of what happened in April 1975 as those US personnel had to scramble to leave the city and the country, and also what they decided to do or not to do to help those people, South Vietnamese and those living in Saigon, who they knew and who they'd been working with, many of them were in relationships with, or who they considered, some of them considered family.
They were very well integrated into the country.
Yeah, absolutely. So some moral dilemmas that come up through that. I found it a pretty gripping film, actually. And it's a micro portrait of this particular chapter in the history of the Vietnam War. I mean, this final chapter is very well put together, and I find it pretty illuminating. Mm.
And Lindsay, if I could turn to you now, would you agree with what Dave said? What was your take on this documentary?
Well, I agree with Dave. I thought it was a very good film, and it got across this sort of moral dilemma very, very well. I think my big criticism of it is not about the film itself, and maybe this shouldn't be a criticism of the film, but that the context of what's going on isn't really developed in the way that it should be. So you see sort of pictures of maps that the North Vietnamese are coming and are surrounding Saigon and are just a few hours away and all this kind of thing, without actually sort of looking at the backstory of what happened. So I think it was it's a very well-made film. It's a very human story because it's about what happens to the people, which can happen in any war where you're on the losing side, and what then happens, and it can be very, very hard for people in that circumstance, and you can understand why both the Americans wanted to get their friends and family out, and also why some of the South Vietnamese thought that if the North Vietnamese came, they wouldn't have much of a future. Mm-hmm. But I think that lack of context also does weaken the film's message, I suppose, or gives you one side of the message. Mm.
And I want to tear apart, actually, the more on the political context of the film in the next part of the discussion. But just for now, we're going to take a brief break.
This big Chinook showed up. There's no way he can land on Kirk without impacting the ship. He would have killed everybody on the helicopter plus my crew.
It was way too big to land. We thought that the helicopter would just fly away. But as the ship was moving forward, probably 4, 5, 6 knots, something like that, the pilot communicated that he was running low on fuel.
He opened up the port side of the helicopter and he hovered across the stern of Kirk. Then all of a sudden, here comes a human.
One by one, we jump out. I jumped out, my brother jumped out. My mom was holding my sister, obviously very scared. And she just, just trustingly, just with one hand, with her right hand, holding on with her left to brace herself, just dropped my baby sister.
One fella standing there, and he said he looked up and he saw this big bundle of stuff come flying out, and it was a baby. It was the 1-year-old baby. And then the mother jumped out and he caught her too.
There are some really great evacuation stories in this film. And just before we went to that clip, as you were saying, this from a cinematic perspective, this documentary is a great documentary. And Lindsay, if I could ask you, what evacuation story stood out the most to you?
Well, I like the whole way that they did it. The thing that perhaps I remember most is this thing where they say that there was this signal, which would, when they knew they had to evacuate, which would come on the radio, and I forget what the phrase was, but then they said they would play Bing Crosby's White Christmas, which I thought was perhaps one of the most bizarre things in terms of what was going on in Vietnam, the whole war and everything. So I suppose that really stood out. But lots and lots of people trying to get there, the people, and even with that message was the message about White Christmas, was you have to come with your family to the embassy with only one suitcase, which I guess is a pretty, all right, it's, you're getting out, but you're getting out with not very much stuff. So I thought they were very moving. And the one about the man who went and got his family, the Vietnamese pilot who went and got his family in his helicopter and just took the helicopter, went and got his family and got them out. So they were very moving stories, I thought, and they were, obviously people were in a very desperate situation.
Indeed, and according to this documentary, the events described in it includes the stories of some 77,000 South Vietnamese people. And Dave, if I could ask you the same question, what story stood out the most for you?
I mean, I agree. I mean, there's very, very many there. And I agree also, actually, yeah, some of those code slogans and things they hear on the radio are particularly, they do stick in the mind. To be honest, actually, I mean, as well as all the stories of the people that do leave, I mean, some of the stories that stick in my mind are the hints of the people that were left behind. I mean, towards the very end of the film, we see some of those very famous images of people clambering over the walls of the US Embassy after the last 11 people are helicoptered away. I mean, one of the many powerful evacuation stories is of the last of the 11 US soldiers are clambering into the helicopter. But there's one there's one person who recalls, a South Vietnamese man who had been a soldier, who recalls how, as soon as he realized, you know, Saigon had fallen, it was over, North Vietnamese were all over the city, and he took off his uniform, got rid of his badge, burnt his military identification card, and just to so he could make it clear that he was just a civilian once again. I think that one story, for me, just sort of powerfully evokes, you know, the idea of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people left behind who would have had to very, very quickly readjust to a different way of life, you know, mm-hmm. potentially, with the threat of being, you know, of recrimination if they had, you know, if it was proved that they had been collaborating with the Americans or had been in the South Vietnamese army.
And now all these stories are very well, but I just want to challenge sort of this heroic narrative, of course, that many mainstream documentaries about the Vietnam War puts across, especially particularly in this documentary, Lindsay. What do you think of this heroic narrative? I mean, it's not in a vacuum. Did the U.S. Soldiers have any business being in Vietnam anyway?
Well, I would argue they didn't, and I think most people now, in terms of the, you know, the 40 years or so since the final fall of Saigon, would argue the same, that it was not a just war. It was an absolutely brutal war, which went on. The French, first of all, fought it because it was their former colony. Then the United States came in. And if you look at what they did, the use of chemical weapons in the form of Agent Orange, which caused massive environmental and human damage. It's estimated that 2 million Vietnamese died, 58,000 US soldiers died. And the US soldiers, I mean, the thing that's very missing from this, and probably accurately it's missing because by that time the regular soldiers had gone, but the soldiers themselves killed many of their officers. It was the biggest sort of mutiny or mutinous atmosphere that the Americans have ever had to deal with in wartime. And of course, many, many soldiers demonstrated when they were back in the States, were involved in the anti-war movement. It was a mass movement. And none of that, of course, comes across. But there was a great sense that this was mm-hmm. an injustice. By the mid-60s, a great sense it was an injustice. And that was reflected not just in the US, in Germany, there were huge demos, in Britain, in all of the Western countries. People were very, very much against it.
That was a very powerful point. And Dave, I'd like to pick up on your thoughts on that also in the next part.
When President Ford went before the Congress, he had two major concerns. The first was to save as many people as we could. He cared for the human beings involved. They were not just pawns that once they had lost their military power were abandoned. The second was the honor of America, that we would not be seen at the final agony of South Vietnam as having stabbed it in the back.
Congress wouldn't pass it. They said no more, you know, no more troops, no more money, no more aid to the Vietnamese. Well, I had to go into President Ford's office to tell him.
Now, Dave, I just wanted to pick up on a point that Lindsay made earlier on before we went to the clip. Would you have liked to have seen more political context to this documentary, perhaps to expose more of the crimes in the area?
I would have. I do think it. I mean, I think it's very good on the micro. It's very good on those final days, those final weeks in Saigon. It's not especially good on the wider context of the war, which, as you said at the very beginning, has spanned two decades. It's not particularly great on the immediate political context, which is hinted at by that clip. Either, I mean, it reduces the background politics to a fairly simple Ford was willing to provide more aid to the South Vietnamese. Congress said no. It does. You mentioned heroism before. I mean, it does point the finger of heroism towards Gerald Ford as well there. Mm-hmm. And obviously Kissinger was in his government at the time, so obviously has, you know, a reason to be pushing that narrative as well. But at the same time, the film doesn't set out to offer that context. I think I'd have been a bit more dismayed if it offered the context in a more simplistic way, or in a more narrow-minded or biased way. And I think it prefers to avoid it, and prefers just to put you into the melee of those final days, and it does mm-hmm. that well.
Mm-hmm.
And Lindsay, following on from that clip, they showed Head Henry Kissinger, who was in this documentary, and some would accuse him of being a war criminal. How do you think he was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I think he's portrayed very favorably in the documentary. And of course, when he says in that clip, you know, we were concerned about human life, I mean, it's a slightly grotesque way to talk about it when you think of how many people had died by the time that he was describing this final evacuation. So I think it's kinder to Kissinger than probably history is or will be to him. I think he played a bad role in all of this. And of course, they kept escalating this war. This is what people forget. This is, it's only in these last years that they de-escalated, and even in 75 they're talking about more money going to prop up what was a puppet government in South Vietnam. You know, it's I think it's quite unsatisfactory at that level, but perhaps not surprising as well. Once you've got Henry Kissinger to interview, which is quite a coup, then you're not going to ask him any challenging questions, probably.
And would you agree with that, Dave?
I would. I mean, it would have been interesting to know. I mean, going back to that particular clip there, and again, the film doesn't really set out to offer this context, but it would have been interesting to know more about the reason, why Congress was so opposed to offering more aid at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, presumably partly because the Vietnam War for the American people had become a massive millstone around the American people's neck, and it was just something that they really wished to put behind them, you know, for many, many valid reasons. But the film doesn't explore that. It leaves those questions begging if you don't bring a lot of knowledge to the film.
Actually, Lindsay, I think that relates to you. I mean, as someone who was inspired into political activism by the Vietnam War, what was the anti-war movement like at that time, and do you think this was affecting Congress's decision?
Well, no, funnily enough, by the time this was happening, the anti-war movement was much weaker than it had been in the late 60s and early 70s, partly because most of the troops had gone. People could see that it was coming to an end. But there was very, very big sentiment against the war, and there was and also the point that Dave makes is right, I think, about the politically people were, it was an absolute millstone around their necks. But also by the mid 70s, the world economy had turned towards very serious recession after decades of boom. Mm-hmm. So of course the Americans were also thinking that we can't really afford this. And it's usually accepted that the Vietnam War was a big driver of inflation in the 60s and early 70s, which led to some of this economic crisis. So I think they just thought, you know, let's get out of here. As the Americans quite often do. We've seen this before and since.
It was a very interesting discussion so far, but we'll just have to pause for now.
I thought of my friends who were killed in action, and I thought, well, is this what we fought for? Is this what the Americans came for? And I didn't have the answer.
I have wrestled with this ever since. I realized that I had become the quintessential American in Vietnam. I had all these causes, all these big things I was doing. I was trying to get the truth back to Washington. I was talking to agents, trying to persuade the ambassador. And I forgot that what was at stake were human lives.
For years after that, I hear that sound in my head, that sound like ch-ch-ch-ch. In the middle of the night, I just jump up. I thought the helicopter would come pick me up. I called it Dream in the Wind.
Absolutely devastating war. Now, Dave, one of the criticisms you can make of this documentary is that the number of people who have died, the casualties from the war, is missing. I mean, it's not until 1995 did Vietnam release its official estimate of the death toll, as many as 2 million civilians on both sides and some 1.1 million North Vietnamese and Viet Cong fighters, whereas the U.S. military actually say that between 200,000 and 250,000 South Vietnamese soldiers died, so it's a fraction compared to the Vietnamese statistics. Do you think this is a weakness of the documentary also? Would you have liked to have seen this more?
I think the film struggles slightly actually to know how to end and how to conclude, because it doesn't do that. It doesn't wrap up with a summary of, because these events are the final events of the Vietnam War, It could very naturally then have a conclusion which wraps up the entire history of a two decade conflict, but it doesn't do that. And I think I pretty welcome the fact it doesn't, because it would turn it into something else. I mean, it does deal with high level politics at some points. You know, it deals with decisions that have to be made by U.S. generals and the U.S. ambassador in Saigon, but it does try to bring it back to the experience of more ground level. And people on both sides, mm-hmm. For Americans and South Vietnamese, wherever it can. I think if it just gave us a load of figures and statistics at the end, it would be a little bit unfaithful to the film it has been before, really. So I think it tries to end on, as we see there, on a more human, a more sorrowful note. Mm. And I think it tries to give a sense of the futility of war generally on the human level. I'm not sure it does that entirely powerfully. I'm not sure it does that as powerfully as it does as it achieves other things throughout the film. Mm. But I think I welcome it trying to end on that note.
Yeah. Which is fair enough, I suppose. And Lindsay, I mean, the US lost some 58,000 troops. Mm. And I've read in my research that this is still a controversial issue as to the US narrative is that they didn't win the war, they didn't lose the war. Why is this such a still controversial issue?
I think it's a very big question still in America. I mean, obviously, the surviving veterans and the surviving anti-war protesters come to that are now older, they're now quite old, they're people who are sort of pensioner age and so on. It's still a very contested thing. There's still a very contested thing. Was it justified? There's still many, many veterans who are disabled and who are mentally and physically ill as a result of the war. And of course, America doesn't like losing wars. I mean, this is Trump's election. You know, he says we don't mind going to war, but we want to be able to win those wars. And of course, Vietnam showed them they couldn't win the wars despite this huge superior air power and military might in general, despite targeting quite deliberately civilians, which they did, who they claimed were sort of hiding the Viet Cong and the people who were fighting. Despite all this, they lost, and they lost because of what the Vietnamese people themselves did. They lost because their own soldiers didn't have the faith in it that perhaps they might have done in previous wars. And they lost because the people at home said, look, we don't want this either. So I think it's still a very big issue in American politics. And, of course, it's mm-hmm. contemporary in the sense that there was what was called the Vietnam Syndrome, which did stop these interventions for the best part of 20 years. Mm-hmm. And now we're back with a vengeance with all of those.
Well, it's very great to see how it relates to today as well. And I'm afraid we'll have to leave the discussion here. I wish we could talk longer. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks to my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.